Welcome, I'm Holly Kernan, and this is Your Call. What is grief? That's a question today's guest, Megan O'Rourke, asked herself after her mother, Barbara, died on Christmas Day 2008 from cancer. Her mother was 55 years old. In her memoir, The Long Goodbye, O'Rourke writes, "Grief is common. We know it exists in our midst, but experience it made me suddenly aware of how difficult it is to confront head-on. When we do, it's usually in the form of self-help. We want to heal our grief, and the rituals of public mourning that once helped channel a person's experience of loss have by and large fallen away. So is there a best way to grieve? What can we learn from other cultures about how we might cope with the loss of a loved one? And how have you grieved? Call and share your stories of mourning and insight into your own process with us. I'll give out the number in just a moment, so grab a pen. Our guest, Megan O'Rourke, is an award-winning essayist and poet. She began her career as one of the youngest editors in the history of The New Yorker. Since then, she's served as cultural editor and literary critic for Slate, as well as poetry editor for the Paris Review. Her latest book, The Long Goodbye, chronicles her mother's cancer and eventual death and her struggle with mourning. Megan joins us from the studios of Scripps College in Claremont. Hi, Megan.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Thank you for joining us. So I wonder if we could start, and maybe you could just tell us a little bit about your mom and your relationship, and then what happened when she got cancer.
Sure, I would love to tell you about my mom. She was a teacher and an administrator. She loved kids and animals. And as my brother recently said, she especially loved you if you were sort of a badly behaved eighth grade boy. She was really good at reaching out to those kinds of kids, really good at understanding them. And she just loved what she did. You know, I think she led a lucky life in that sense. But very sadly, she was diagnosed with stage 4 colorectal cancer when she was 52 years old. Which, you know, for those of you who've lost family members, certainly feels too early, even though it's not as early as many people lose loved ones. And she kind of miraculously lived with this very advanced cancer for about 2.5 years and even went into remission for about 9 months, which was a wonderful period where we got to really get to know each other and really appreciate the time we had. But unfortunately, the cancer came back and she died about a year later on Christmas Day, which was her favorite day of the year.
Hmm. And so what was that like for you to experience that loss and the experience of grief and mourning? What happened next?
Well, you know, it kind of takes a whole book to describe that, which
we've got a whole hour, so, and then people can get the book after that.
Which is, you know, what The Long Goodbye is about, is trying to really convey something about the lived experience of loss as opposed to other books that look back on loss, right? So in my book, I'm really trying to kind of describe loss from the inside out. And for me, that loss was very devastating. I was really close to my mom. You know, of course, we had our squabbles and those sorts of things, but we were very close, and I was not ready for her to die. And one of the things I talk about in the book is that even though so many of us now have this experience of having a loved one who's sick for a long time, and we kind of know on some level that they're going to die, I found that when my mother actually died, I was not prepared at all for that reality and what it was like. There was something, you know, knowing she would die was very different from the fact of her being dead. Mm-hmm. So one of the things that led me to write about grief was I felt that our culture really didn't understand it, right? That I lost my mom when I was 32, and not many of my friends had gone through a similar loss. And although they were very well-intentioned, they just didn't know necessarily what to do.
And can I read something from your book?
Please. Please, go ahead.
When my mother died at Christmas a year ago, I wondered what I was supposed to do in the days afterward. And many friends, especially those who had not yet suffered an analogous loss, seemed equally confused. Some sent flowers but didn't call for weeks. Others sent well-meaning emails a week or so later, saying, "I hoped I was well, and is there anything I can do to help?" And then you say, "One friend launched into 15 minutes of small talk before asking who I was." And it strikes me, I've seen this in my own life with other friends, that people around you don't know how to deal with it.
Absolutely. I think, you know, we're very frightened of it. We don't understand it. And what I try to explore in my book is the fact that in the 20th century, we kind of privatized grief. You know, until then, in pretty much every culture across the world over many centuries, almost every culture, I think every culture really had a kind of set of mourning rituals that helped, theoretically helped, maybe they didn't always help, but they, you know, were there to help mourners deal with their private loss by kind of creating a communal mourning, right? And so people would come to your door with bread and soup and support. And there wasn't an expectation that you were supposed to kind of pick yourself up and go back to work and, you know, the sort of current American fantasy that you should just dive into your work and, like, you know, drive
muscle
your sorrow away
it.
By muscling through it, right? Which is our fantasy of, like, what strength and character is today. And it's really not how many people, some people experience grief that way and some people are able to do that, but many, many people are not. And I certainly felt that I was supposed to do that and that there was something wrong with me because I wasn't doing that. And I certainly found that grief was physiological in a way I hadn't expected, right? I had insomnia. It was difficult to concentrate. I got sick a lot.
And apparently the science of grief says that those are many of the symptoms associated with it.
Exactly.
A compromised immune system, insomnia, et cetera.
Exactly. So I was very curious about this and I started reading about it and I found that, in fact, the science of grief showed that, you know, muscling through it might just not be an option for a lot of people, right? That in fact, when we study grief, we do find that it is a physiological reaction as well as an emotional reaction. Our stress hormones like cortisol rise, for example. And so I became really interested in the fact that, exactly as you're saying, people didn't know how to deal with this. It was a much more, grief was not just being sad. You know, I had sort of imagined before my mom died, naively, that it would be just like feeling sad and that each day I would feel a little less sad until one day I didn't feel sad, you know, and that was really not at all what it was like. It was much more of a roller coaster. Sometimes I was upset and angry about things that didn't have anything to do with my mother, and it took me a long time to see that they were kind of ways I was displacing or dealing with my grief or my sadness, you know. And I was just very interested in the lack of the social component, the lack of social support, and not just for my sake, but for my friends who really wanted to help but really did not know what to do.
So I wonder if you could tell us about some of these cultural rituals that we may have lost or that some of us may have lost being a nation of immigrants. Can you just explain some of these, you know, more collective
sure.
rituals? And actually, before you do that, let me invite our listeners to join us. The number is 1-866-798-TALK. That's 8255. 866-798-TALK. You can remain anonymous if that's comfortable for you. You're listening to Your Call. I'm Holly Kernan, and I'm speaking with Megan O'Rourke, who's the author of the memoir, The Long Goodbye. And she says most Westerners are uncomfortable around death and the rituals that once guided us have mostly disappeared. So what is it like to mourn? Have you coped with the death of a loved one? Can you share your experience with us? The number is 866-798-8255. And if you have advice for those who are dealing with a loved one, somebody who's dear to us, a friend who has experienced loss, do you have advice on kind of the do's and the don'ts of helping somebody through a death, a painful death? The number again is 866-798-8255. And Megan, you were going to talk to us about some of the cultural rituals that you looked into in researching this book.
Yeah, well, I wanted to say that, you know, before my mom died, I think I was really skeptical of rituals. And I'm not setting ritual out to be a panacea, because I think there can be problems with rituals too. But after she died, I was really struck by how psychological grief has become. So the fact that you would go out and people would say, "How are you?" And you were supposed to answer. But if you answered truthfully, it might make them uncomfortable, right? And so you were in this position of either kind of lying or telling the truth. And that's when I started to think, oh, there's really something to the idea of a ritual, because people can get together and share the experience of loss, maybe thinking of their own losses in a non-psychological way that doesn't put the emphasis on the individual mourner and what their experience was. So I began reading about rituals, and one of the things that really interested me was that when you look at many of them across cultures, they share the fact that they occur at very similar times over the course of at least a year. So in Catholicism, you know, in Ireland, you would have the three-day wake, right? And in many cultures, there would be this tradition of cleaning the body, mm-hmm. saying goodbye to the body, kind of telling stories, doing things to kind of ward off maybe the evil spirits, and then burying the body.
Or Shiva in Jewish
culture.
Well,
Shiva is different, right. Well, in Shiva, they, in the Jewish culture, they bury the body much more quickly, but then, right, they have this period of sitting Shiva and telling stories about the person. And one of my favorite rituals is Shiva. And in fact, the kind of traditional Shiva, when I was reading about it in years past, what would happen was that people, say a woman's husband died, people would come to the room, and if she was sitting on the floor and looked up and started telling stories about her husband, then they would follow. And if she, by contrast, kind of looked down and was quiet, then they would follow that. So it's a beautiful ritual of kind of taking your cue from the main mourner, the primary mourner, but sharing and mirroring that experience without kind of putting pressure on that person to either talk or not talk, right? Similarly, there's a lot of rituals that occur around 30 days, between 30 and 50 days, which when you look at sort of psychological literature about grief that we've started to study it, it does seem like there's a kind of shift around then for many people. And then again, in many cultures, there's a really important ritual around the time of the year. In the Jewish tradition, it's the unveiling of the headstone at, I think, 11 months. In many other traditions, there would be a kind of revisiting at 12, at the year anniversary. And those dates ended up being dates that were really meaningful for me as I was mourning. And it became really interesting to think about what have we lost when we've kind of, there's nothing we can do about it. We live in a very heterogeneous culture where we don't necessarily, live close to our loved ones. And so we're not in small communities that can support us in the way that we once could do.
And you write, mourning requires other people, or you may have been quoting somebody, this is from your New Yorker article, to lose someone was once to be swept into a flurry of rituals in many nations, among them China and Greece. Death was met with wailing and lamentation among family and neighbors. Among Hindus, friends visit the house of the bereaved for 12 days and chant hymns to urge the soul on to the next world. We're getting a lot of calls. There is an author, Cheryl Strayed, whose mother died of cancer at 45. She writes, whenever people say to someone who's experiencing a big loss, oh, I don't know how you could do that, I couldn't go on, in an effort to be consoling, I always bristle. I appreciate that they're trying to be kind, but nobody has a choice about going on. I had to go on without my mother, even though I was suffering terribly, grieving her. My whole life sort of ended when my mom died. I had to remake it again and be a new person in the world without my mom. It was a very primal rebirth. Her experience sounds somewhat similar to yours, and you write in your article about this need to sort of reassess your place in the world when somebody who's so central to it dies.
Absolutely. When I think one of the things that anyone who's lost somebody knows is that when you lose a loved one, you don't just lose them, you lose your relationship with them, right? So that you don't get to be the person that you were with that person. So in my case, my mom is, the only other female family member in my close family. And so there are just certain kinds of days that I don't have anymore, of kind of going shopping or talking together, or getting a tea. That just was, there's no one like that, right? And I think your listeners know that feeling of having to find pieces of that relationship in other relationships, but never being able to recreate it.
And I wonder how you feel about this notion that I have personally, which is that the relationship doesn't necessarily end with death. Obviously, it's very different, but I find myself still talking to people who I was close to in my life who died.
Oh, absolutely. And I love that idea. I mean, it's of course not quite
the it's not the same
you want
no.
to have. It's not the same, but I absolutely agree. And I think a lot about children who lost a parent before they were able to really remember them and how that's a real loss on a level that, certainly mine wasn't. I really do. I talked to a friend of mine who's a poet, and her son had died, and she was really struggling with this. Obviously I think the death of a child is one of the most difficult deaths to endure. And she was talking to a psychiatrist and saying, she was saying, I feel like I can hear my son's voice. And the psychiatrist said something which I love, which he said, well, you can, because your brain has actually been formed by your relationship with him. So he's actually in the synapses of your brain, you know, the way that you think, the way the memories you have, like his voice, his being is in there. And absolutely, I often feel that about my mother. And I don't know about you, but I periodically dream about her in a way where it really does feel like she's come for a visit. And afterward, I wake up sad, but also really pleased to have seen her.
Very nice. I'm Holly Kernan. You're listening to Your Call. We're speaking with Megan O'Rourke, who's the author of The Long Goodbye. And it's all about grieving, her own process of grieving after losing her mother to cancer in 2008. And it looks into the whole history of grief and mourning, both in the United States, in the Western Hemisphere, and in other cultures, and kind of contrasts a lot of that. And we've got a lot of callers, Megan, so I'm going to bring them into our conversation. Let's go to Steve in Santa Cruz. Hi, Steve. Thank you so much for calling.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. Listen, I've got to tell you, if it's tough for women, imagine how being like a man and losing a parent.
Yeah.
I came to the conclusion that your so-called friends are basically virtually no help with emotional support when you're a guy. And I don't mean that to be harsh. I'm just saying, they want to come over and talk about the surf and maybe, you know, have a beer and, you know, talk about the game. They don't even really know how to be supportive. But to get to be more specific, when my mother passed away, I felt like I really didn't even like my mother because she had been an alcoholic and an abusive mother. And then I got a phone call from my ex one day, and she said, Steve, it's your mom. And I knew right away she died, and I yelled out, no. And I knew in that moment that she was gone, and I felt like I'd been kicked in the stomach. And it took, physically, it took me about a week. I felt like, I felt virtually just physically devastated by the news. And I didn't even like, felt like I didn't really like her that much. It was kind of a crushing blow. Took me a long, but I think, I just want to say the thing that got me through it was I was living in San Juan Capistrano, and there was a little church there that I was frequenting. I didn't even know the people because I was new to town down there, but they rallied around and gave me so much unconditional support just because they were, you know, that sort of spiritual community like that. They hardly even knew me, but yet they could relate. And there was this, I don't know, kind of a tribal spiritual support system network just by being, you know, close to them. And I was so amazed at the kind of the unconditional love I got from those people. It really got me through it.
Steve, thank you so much for sharing your story. I hope you can stay on for just a minute. You brought up so many things in that. The first one being how different it may be for a man and a woman to grieve. Women are sort of allowed in our society to show lots of emotion, especially like sadness. And men oftentimes are expected to buck up. Megan, do you want to respond to that?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's such an important point that Steve, you brought up. And it's something I read a lot about when I was writing the book, and I come from a family of now two brothers and a dad, and the day after my mom died at the dinner table, everyone was talking about football because, you know, that was what they knew how to talk about. Mm-hmm. And I have a wonderful family. They're all very expressive, but I thought, I absolutely see that it's very difficult for men in this culture, and I think that it becomes really important to find a kind of community like the one you found, either a spiritual community or a community of other mourners who you connect to somehow, because they do understand, right? They're kind of part of what a friend of mine referred to as the club that no one wants to be in. But, you know, it's very interesting. A lot of there is research about the differences in the genders and how they grieve. And I'm always a bit skeptical about that research because I think, we tend to exaggerate the differences in genders and not pay attention to the similarities. But certainly they have found that men tend to be less verbal about it. And it would be obviously interesting hard to be in a position where you wanted to be able to talk about it and the people around you were not able to verbalize
Megan,
that stuff in the same way.
Indeed. The other, I mean, Steve brought up a myriad of issues, but another thing that he brought up that I thought was really interesting is if you had a difficult relationship with somebody but was still a very important piece of your life, obviously, in some ways it might make it harder to go through the grieving process, or at least more complex.
Absolutely, and this is a really important piece, that there is some, I don't want to refer constantly to studies about grief, because one of the points that I really try to make in the book is that everyone grieves in their own way. There are some similarities, but there's not a wrong way to grieve. But absolutely, you know, when we study people who've mourned, when we talk to them, it looks like people who have a relationship like the one, Steve, you had with your mom, it makes it really difficult because you haven't had that goodbye, that moment of kind of feeling like there's an understanding between you. And I think even when you have a difficult relationship with a parent, there's always a little bit of this fantasy when you're their child, you know, that someday you'll be kind of reconciled, or someday they'll be the parent you want them to be. And to lose that, and to have to experience the ambivalence of losing someone one is maybe angry at or doesn't totally respect, but obviously on some level one is so deeply connected to that person. That's a really difficult, confusing kind of grief to process.
Yeah, and we're about to go to a break, so if you could just answer this one in like 2 minutes. I'm going to go to call. I know we have a lot of callers, and I'm going to get to them right after the break. But one of the things that you write about is it seems to you that grief is like the last taboo. And Steve mentioned this, that his friends had no idea how to surround him with support.
Yes, I think grief frightens us because death frightens us maybe more than it did in cultures that were less secular. And so we avoid it, right? It's like being on an island. To be the mourner is like being on an island that other people can look at, but they're not joining you on it. They may want to, and they may not want to. As Steve said, I mean, you kind of quickly find out which of your friends can go there and which can't. So I do think that in our very open culture, death is really still, this is becoming less true, but death really is still kind of one of the last taboos.
And you're listening to Your Call. I'm Holly Kernan. We're speaking with Megan O'Rourke, who's the author of the memoir, The Long Goodbye. And we're talking about grief and how different cultures deal with it. And we're asking the question if in the Western world we've become isolated and kind of privatized grief, which for human history has really been kind of a public ritual. And if you've dealt with a loss, we'd like to hear about the grieving process for you. The number to call is 866-798-8255. You can also send us an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org, because we have a lot of callers on the line. That's feedback@yourcallradio.org. Are your mourning rituals anchored in another culture or religion? If they are, we'd like to hear about that. And let us know what your cultural rituals are and how they've affected your grieving process. And do you have advice for friends and family about what to say and what not to say to someone who's lost a loved one? The number to call is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. Or you can send us a note to feedback@yourcallradio.org. And just to let you know, tomorrow we're going to be talking about how can we break the cycle of violence against women and girls. February 14th is V-Day, a coordinated day of action, including a dance flash mob. And the Violence Against Women Act is also currently up for reauthorization in Congress. So how do we deal with the socialization that leads to this violence? That will be on Your Call tomorrow with Rose Aguilar. On Friday, of course, it's our media roundtable, and we're going to be talking with a group of photojournalists about the week's news coverage, and that's all coming up. Next week, we'll also have a show about photojournalism in the Central Valley, so be looking for that show. And again, if you want to join our conversation, we have full lines right now, but they'll be open soon. I'm Holly Kernan, and this is Your Call. We'll be right back after this short break.
You're listening to Your Call on KALW 91.7 FM. There are many ways you can take part in the conversation on Your Call, on the phone, via email, or on our website, yourcallradio.org. Although the lines are full now, I'll give you the number. It's 866-798-TALK. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org.
For those of you who are joining us now, I'm Holly Kernan, and this is Your Call. We're podcasting our show, and you can find more information at yourcallradio.org. That's also where you can listen to past shows. And if you have a show idea for us, you can drop us a line at feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website, which is yourcallradio.org. And today we're talking about grief and loss with Megan O'Rourke, who's the author of The Long Goodbye. We'll put all of that information at our website, which is yourcallradio.org. We have so many callers, Megan, who want to talk to you. So let's go to Judith in San Francisco. Hi, Judith. Thanks so much for calling.
Oh, thank you for taking my call. Well, I have this most incredible story, but let me tell you that currently I am grieving my husband who died August 8th.
Oh, Judith, we're so sorry.
Thank you. And he was a poet. And yesterday, I just finished his Galleys. The book is still coming out. I'm going to be mailing that to the publisher this afternoon once I can get myself out of the house and go over and make photocopies. But death has been a part of my life. My mother died when I was 5, and I was the youngest of 8 children, and the age span was 22 years. So as my older sisters started passing, the one story, you know, when somebody mentioned that, how grief can affect you physically, I think this is a fascinating story, and everybody who's ever heard it said, wow. My sister died. I was in my 20s when she died, and she was probably just about my favorite sister. And she died back in Albany, New York, so I had to fly back there. And you know, you said you have to have a support system. When I came back here, I just didn't talk to anybody. I was at work, and I happened to walk by a group of coworkers, and somebody said, oh, here comes Judith. You know how she is. Don't say anything about dying. She'll get hysterical. So I never opened my mouth. She died in September, and then about October, November, I started getting very heavy periods. And I mean, really heavy periods. It was coming out of me in chunks. And I passed out at work in May, and they called an ambulance, and they put me in, took me to the hospital, and it was a learning hospital, and people kept coming by and taking blood out of me and telling me I was anemic, and I jokingly said, well, you keep taking all this blood out of me, of course I'm anemic. So somebody on the psychiatric,
psychiatric evaluation team,
practice or whatever. And he came by and he said, Judith, he said, did anybody in your family die recently? And I said, no. See, I completely wiped it out of my mind.
But your body didn't.
And he said, oh, well, I'm going to come back tomorrow. So he came back, and of course, during the day, and I said, oh, my God, what am I doing? Of course, Lois died. So he came back the next morning, and I said, oh, I forgot to tell you, my sister died. He said, oh, I knew somebody did. He said, you see what's happening to you since you didn't handle your grief. Your body handled it for you. He said, we call that the weeping womb.
Do you want to respond to that, Megan?
You say you have to talk about it. Right now I belong to a support group. And everything you said, you know, the men who are in it go through the same thing. It's just amazing. The support groups are wonderful. I have no idea what I would be doing without my support group. But the idea that it can physically impact you.
Yeah, it's not surprising after reading all of Megan's research. I'm wondering, Judith, was editing your late husband's poetry, was that useful as a grieving ritual?
It's, you know, I just, you know, I had a friend who was a poet. She offered to help. And then I just redid it. And, you know, I just can't tell you how calming and how wonderful that is for me to go through it. It's just like it's been a gift that's handed to me.
Yeah, that makes sense. And when it gets published, it'll be another one. Let's get a response, Judith, from Megan.
I mean, I'm very sorry to hear about your husband and all these losses. And it absolutely makes sense to me that your body would respond in this way, especially women's bodies, which are so cyclical and, you know, hormones are affected by stress, certainly. So I think that was an instance of your body telling you, hey, you know, something major is going on. And I think, again, this is part of why it's really important not to kind of smush one's grief down inside oneself. And that may mean talking about it. That may mean, you know, if your daughter or your husband was a gardener or your wife was a gardener, going and gardening. You know, it can mean whatever it means for you. But I think it's another reminder of just how we really are. Our emotions really do connect, certainly in grieving, to our bodies.
Yeah, and if we don't do it, our bodies will do it for us. Let's go to another caller, Megan. Elijah in Soledad, welcome to your call. Thank you for calling.
Thank you for answering my call. My name is Elijah from Nigeria. I've been in America for 10 years in America. I lost my dad years ago. And he was a pastor. He affected because
Elijah, I am so sorry to interrupt you, but we can't hear you because your line is really, really bad. Can you call us back, maybe pull over to the side of the road?
I'm pulling over. I got pulled over right now.
Great. Okay, so, and try and speak a little louder. Go ahead.
Hear me now?
Yes, much better.
Okay. So, so he died 2 years ago, and I was very close with my dad. But what I want to ask you, like, even till now, I'm married, and sometimes I'll see my dad in a dream. You know, like, it's like we'll be talking about stuff that we used to talk about or some things that we have different views about when he was alive. And even there are some church member that will see my dad in a dream, you know, like, oh, tell them to go to church. You know, like you, some of them will be going through some things, and you will talk to them in their dreams, you know, that are about what they are going through. How would you explain that kind of notion apart from the Christianity view?
Well, thank you for sharing your story, Elijah. Can I ask you a question? You say that you're originally from Nigeria. Did your father die in Nigeria?
Yes.
Were you able to be with him or to attend the funeral?
No. I couldn't, because I couldn't afford it. And besides, when he died, I was about to get into nursing school.
Mm-hmm.
So I couldn't because it was an expensive school, and that was my second attempt to get into that school.
That seems really difficult. We're sorry for your loss. I'm going to get Megan to respond. I wanted to mention that a dear friend of mine also had that experience of her mother dying in another country from which she was exiled, so she couldn't go back and have those last moments. I wonder how that affects mourning. Megan?
Yeah, you know, I think it's really difficult not to be able to say goodbye and not to be able to see the dead. In other words, one of the things that we discover, you know, and certainly I think mourners feel this, your listeners will understand this, that even when you see somebody die, there's so many moments of disbelief, right? Because that person has always been there and then suddenly they're gone. This strikes me as one of the reasons why there were these rituals where people would really spend time with the dead body, you know, to kind of see that there was a transition, a transformation. And I think your caller was asking about, you know, are these dreams, you know, is his father still alive in an afterlife coming back? And, you know, obviously we all have so many different beliefs and explanations for this kind of thing. I mean, and, there is something that feels extremely supernatural, I know, about those visitations. They feel like visitations, many of those dreams. And, you know, obviously I don't know what the answer to that is. I think we all have to try to find our own belief about that.
And whatever gives you comfort or works for you is fine, right?
Right. But I just want to say that certainly I know that experience he's talking about of feeling, I just had a dream like this where it really feels like it's a visitation, not something created by your own, you know, memory. So that's a very powerful experience.
Well, thank you so much, Elijah, for calling in. I want to get to some more callers, but somebody emailed and said, my mother died last summer. She had moved to live near us because she suffered dementia. So my daughter, who's 7, had spent a lot of time with my mother in recent months. My daughter was hit very hard by her grandmother's death, partially, I think, because the finality of death was made real to her. She cried a lot, as I did. To help with the grieving process, we tried to include my daughter in all of our rituals, including the funeral and spreading my mom's ashes at Baker's Beach. My daughter wrote notes to my mother in the sand and let the waves come up and wash them to sea. And we also let my daughter choose whether she wanted to spread the ashes, and she did. I think it helped her because she wasn't in the hospital when my mother passed, and since my mother was not buried, for my daughter to witness. I'm wondering, Megan, children who lose a parent or a significant other, a grandparent, that grieving process must be a little bit different because they're not as mature and maybe don't have some of the coping mechanisms, or maybe, I don't know, but what advice do you have for people who have a child who's dealing with loss?
It's such a difficult situation. My father-in-law just died, and we have a 3-year-old niece, and this was one of the things that I know her mother and father, my sister-in-law and brother-in-law, were struggling with, was, you know, she was very close to her grandfather. I think that's so beautiful what the person who wrote in did, and so helpful for her daughter.
Yeah.
The main thing that we know, sometimes our instinct is to protect the child, especially a young child.
Like,
right?
Not let him go to the funeral, for example.
Right. Not let them go, not talk about it, kind of change the subject. That turns out probably not to be that helpful. Of course, there's a certain protection, right? We don't want to let them see someone who's in the hospital hooked up to machines. That would be very traumatic for a young child. But children really also need, they're smart, right? We all know this, like, they pick up on things, mm-hmm. and they can sense something is wrong. And I think the best things you can do, and I've talked to psychiatrists about this, and those would be good people to talk to, are really to let them ask questions, let them return to the subject, try to involve them in some way that would not be traumatic for them. And that's why I think those rituals were so apt, you know, the writing letters and letting them wash out to sea, and really give them a space to process the grief. And above all, never make them feel like it's wrong for them to want to know about it or ask about it, or that they're in any way to blame, right? Because children can internalize parents' stress or family stress in all sorts of ways. So really letting them have their own process with it. And I know that there are some really good books out there for little kids that, you know, you can read.
And that's Megan O'Rourke. She's the author of the memoir, The Long Goodbye, which examines grief and grieving, both the history of it and her own process. And you're listening to Your Call. I'm Holly Kernan. The number, if you want to join our conversation about mourning and advice to people who are either in mourning or your own experience with it, give us a call at 866-798-8255. That's a toll-free number, 866-798-TALK. And you can also email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org. I'll get to some of those emails in just a moment. But let's go to Fontaine in San Francisco. Hi, Fontaine. Thank you so much for calling.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for taking my call. I wanted to call in because I lost my mom of breast cancer when I was 9 years old. I'm 29 now. So coming up in May, it's going to be the 20th anniversary of her death, which is pretty crazy. But excuse me, it's interesting to hear you guys talk about what to do for children in that situation, and then having gone through it as a child and then seeing it now for what it is and kind of thinking about what it was like for me then and how it continues to be strange.
Yeah.
One of the things you were talking about earlier in the show that was really resounding for me is that I went to school the day after she died, which is kind of...
How did that feel? Was that a choice you made, or...
It was. I have 4 older siblings, 2 of whom were in their 20s and they were away at college. And then my 2 more immediate brothers, the 3 of us were given the choice whether or not to go to school. And 2 of us went and 1 stayed home, which is kind of interesting to, you know, talk to my brothers about now at this point, mm-hmm. as adults, kind of what that was like. But one of the strangest things was just dealing with my friends and making them feel comfortable with it. Because especially as a kid, your mom just died. You're such a weirdo, you know?
Yeah. And that's probably everybody else's greatest fear, right?
Yeah, exactly. And no one knows what to do with it. And it's been interesting also to take that throughout life. You know, I grew up in a small town in Mendocino County. And so a lot of people knew who I was just for the fact of the death of my mother was a big deal in our small town. And so when I went to the larger public high school, it was kind of a feeder for a bunch of elementary schools, I would meet kids whose parents already knew who I was because of that. So it was strange to be identified in that way. And then to have to try to fit into some idea of what that made me, you know, like who was I because this tragedy happened to me?
Yeah.
And how did it define me? And then to carry it on through when I left and went to college and was totally anonymous. And then it would come out like, oh, where are you from? What do your parents do? And I would always just sort of answer, you know, my dad runs a vineyard and, you know, wouldn't really talk about my mom. But when it would come out, it was always interesting to, again, be in that same situation of making people feel really uncomfortable by this information.
Fontaine, do you have a plan for the 20th anniversary? Are you going to do anything special?
You know, I was talking to a friend about that, and every year I kind of struggle with what to do. Because, you know, another part of it is that I was so young, I didn't know her as a person. And so the mourning that I've gone through over the years has really changed. And it kind of hits me in really unexpected ways. So I don't really know how to relate to her still. It's still a struggle. You know, it's not exactly as she was saying before, you know, it's not like you're sad for a while and then you get less sad and then it's over. It's there all the time. It just changes and takes new shape.
Do you talk with your other siblings about this? Are you able to kind of process the grief together?
Yeah, we live all across the country. There's, you know, I'm in San Francisco. There's New York, Kentucky, Georgia, one in Northern California. And we do get together a lot. We don't, you know, we're kind of Irish Catholics, so we don't do a lot of
I can relate.
Really stuff. However, there are a lot of stories that are passed around, which is really great. So, and my dad in particular has always been really fantastic. It's one of my favorite things, sitting around the dinner table when stories of my mom come up. And then I learn about her in those ways of just stories that people tell.
Well, Fontaine, let's see if Megan, who can easily relate to a lot of what you're saying, has something to respond.
Oh, first of all, Fontaine, I just want to say I'm so sorry, and I can really understand how this would be an ongoing experience. I kept thinking after my mom died, and, you know, I was a grown-up. I was 30, but I didn't have kids, and there's so much in my life that I had hoped to share with her, and I kept thinking that the experience was like a tree that was growing and runs into an obstacle and then has to grow around that obstacle, right? It's less like a certain limb gets cut off and more like your whole trajectory as a person has changed. What I think is so interesting about what you're talking about and so difficult is one of the things that we forget about grief is that there's a private and a public component. And one of the strangest things is the gap between how we experience it in private and then how we express it in public and how, you know, people in your school were mirroring back to you in some way like that you were you were the grief-stricken child and people were expecting you to be the grief-stricken child, and that's such a difficult and strange kind of experience to have. I wonder if your mom ever wrote letters or kept journals and whether you've ever been able to read any of those, because that would seem like that would be one way of trying to hear her voice.
And actually, literally, hear her voice. I used to root around through stuff like this in my dad's house a lot, and I've come upon some really crazy treasures, and some of them were notebooks that I thought were going to be really awesome and insightful, and particularly growing up, and I got to the point where I'm like, lost my virginity, you know, didn't know, like, when did my mom have sex, and what was that about, and who did she date, which, like, what was her view on that? She was from the South, pretty conservative. Was that even an option? Like, you know, all of those questions that I just will never have answers to as those came up. And then which sort of brings on mourning at different stages, you know?
Mourning absolutely.
As an adult, going to weddings, going to my friend's weddings and realizing she's not going to be at my wedding, you know?
Yeah.
All of that kind of stuff. But so I came across some tapes that she had her tarot cards read probably 2 weeks before she died, and they taped it, and it's kind of funny. I found it maybe 8 years ago and have never listened to it in its entirety in one fell swoop, because it's a lot.
And that gives you something that you can sort of look forward to as well.
Yeah, it is, and it's but it's wild because she's, you know, she's pretty heavily medicated because she's in a lot of pain at that point. She's, you know, near the end of her life. And so there's points where she's sort of loopy and not really with it. But then she has very lucid comments, and she talks about the five of us, her five kids, and in these, and it's just, it's kind of crazy.
Well, thank you so much for sharing your story, Fontaine. We really appreciate it, and sorry for your loss.
Let's, no, absolutely. Can I add one last thing?
Very quickly, just because we have so many callers, and I want to honor them as well. Go ahead.
Absolutely. I was just going to say that the last thing, a suggestion for people who know people who have lost someone close to them, just say something. Don't stay quiet, because, you know, just let them know that you're there. It's awkward for everyone, but just reach out to that person whatever way you can. It makes everyone feel better.
Thank you so much,
Absolutely.
Fontaine. That's great. Let's go to Damon in New York. Hi, Damon.
Hi. Thanks a lot for taking my call. I was and Megan, I love your book. It's fantastic.
Thank you.
I was calling because I was wondering whether or not you thought there was anything that could be done in the stages leading up to death. Or, you know, particularly cases of very sick people, there are things that could be done to potentially, over time, make the grieving process easier. For example, in your book, you talk a lot about sort of disturbing environment that a hospital provides. And and I'm just wondering if you think that, you know, what sort of changes you think could be, what sort of adjustments could be made in order to find an easier way to go through that part of the process.
Great. Damon, I'm going to go ahead and let Megan respond, just because we're running out of time and your line isn't very good. Go ahead.
Damon, thank you. Thank you so much. I think that's such an important question, so thank you for asking it. I do think hospitals are a very difficult, very traumatic place to be with somebody dying, partly because they have so many rules and they're not comfortable. I am a big, big advocate of at-home hospice, and I think that one of the things that our denial of death can do is, you know, we so want our loved ones to stay alive that we blind ourselves a bit, maybe, to what's actually happening. So I think if we as people can come to that moment where we acknowledge if someone's dying and bring that person home, and if at-home hospice is possible, I think that is just such a better, a more dignified way of dying, and that loved one will be more comfortable. There's a very interesting study that I encourage people to read about. It was written about in the Times, that did show that people who had terminal diseases like cancer, who went into hospice earlier, actually ended up living longer and having better quality of life than those who did not. So I think that's very interesting. And furthermore, that the people who survived them found their grief less traumatic. So I think that speaks to everything you were talking about.
And Megan, let me read an email from Angela. She says, I teach classes on death and memory and have done a lot of research on these topics of grief, both historical and contemporary mourning practices. But oddly, when I experienced the recent death of my grandmother, I didn't know what to do. My sense of how to function was completely suspended. I had to keep reminding myself that it was okay to just do nothing, to just be silent. I think the awkward moments came from trying to fill that silence, and it left me feeling artificial. Thank you for that note, Angela. We had a caller, Nancy, in San Francisco, who couldn't stay on, but she had a friend who was murdered and she's seeking a ritual. So I wonder if you could talk about these difficult situations where maybe a loved one was murdered or a loved one committed suicide, and, you know, these are kind of taboos and it's harder to deal with. Any advice on that for Nancy?
Well, first of all, it goes back to what the person who wrote in said, which is that we kind of have to permit ourselves to have the grief we have. You know, we sometimes want to have a different kind of grief, or we think we can tidy our grief up or make it better. And the truth is, it's just a lot of pain, you know, and we are going to go through that. And it's sort of allowing ourselves to be present for the pain and asking those around us, and this is for all those who are friends and family of those who've lost, you know, people, that your job is to recognize and reflect that loss. And, you know, as your earlier caller said, just to say something, or, you know, not to kind of put it under the rug. I mean, trust me, you know, people kept saying, I'm worried I'll remind you of it. And I was like, I'm never forgetting that my mother is dead. But as for the ritual, I think that's such a difficult situation. I don't have a really helpful piece of advice except to say that find something that maybe makes you think of that friend that honors her. If it was that you two took walks together in a certain park, you know, maybe to try to take that walk with other one love, you know, friends. I certainly found writing to be an extremely helpful ritual. In a way, my book was a kind of morning, writing the book was a kind of morning ritual. And I think even if you're not a writer, I know for many people, writing down things about that loved person is very helpful somehow. But I think finding a ritual that honors your relationship with her, whatever that might be, and maybe has other people involved, might be really, you know, helpful.
And I know we have a lot of callers that we're not going to be able to get to. If you have advice for people, you can go to yourcallradio.org, and in the comments section, you can continue this conversation. Before we leave, we just have about a minute left, Meg, and I'm wondering, what advice do you have for loved ones? What kinds of things? I know you said engage, but I'm wondering, is it useful to have that person tell you about the person who died? What kinds of things can people do that might actually be helpful?
Well, first of all, I want to say that we all have, you know, we all want to help, and the difficulty is that we can't help because we can't bring the loved one back, right? So our help is going to be sometimes rebuffed or rejected, and that's okay. But I think the primary thing is just to show recognition, right? To use the name of the person who died, that's a really important one. To say, I'm so sorry about Anne, I'm so sorry about your husband, you know, just to bring that person up. If you think of a story about them, certainly to send a condolence card. I mean, these things don't, you know, change the difficulty, but I think that they do create a web of support. I did a survey about grief with Liat Grenek on Slate.com, and we wrote about what you can do for a loved one. So you could certainly Google that, and it has a lot of information about what mourners said that they wanted.
Thank you so much. We're going to have to leave it there. We've been speaking with Megan O'Rourke, who's an award-winning essayist and poet. Her latest book, The Long Goodbye, chronicles her mother's cancer and eventual death, and it's based on a series of essays she wrote for Slate. We'll put a link to all of that information at yourcallradio.org. And thank you for joining us, Megan. I want to thank everybody who called and emailed. I apologize that we couldn't get to all of them. I'm Holly Kernan, and here's what's coming up tomorrow. How can we break the cycle of violence against women and girls? On the next Your Call, we'll talk about solutions to gender violence. February 14th is V-Day, a coordinated day of action, including a dance flash mob. The Violence Against Women Act is also currently up for reauthorization by Congress. But what is the socialization that leads to this violence? Join us at 10 or email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org. How can honest conversations with young people help to break this cycle? It's Your Call with Rose Aguilar and you.
Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter, or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Raz is on, and Ali Budner produced the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Eric Jansen is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.